Well, last week we discussed that the noted Hebrew Bible scholar, Everett Fox, chose a method to look at the book of Exodus that involved dividing it into six divisions. Now, today we enter the first division that he calls the deliverance narrative. It starts at Exodus 1:1, continues through chapter 15. So for the next month or so, we're going to be looking at all that God did to gain his chosen people's release from Pharaoh, beginning with the rescue of the infant Moses from the Nile, ending just after the parting of the Red Sea, which completes Israel's escape from the hand of Pharaoh. Now, just for you note takers, the second division that Mr. Fox calls the wilderness starts at the end of 15, goes through chapter 18. Part 3, covenant and law, starts at 19, goes through 24. Part 4, the plan of the wilderness tabernacle, begins at chapter 25, goes through 31. The fifth division, infidelity and reconciliation, starts at chapter 32, goes on through 34. And finally, the building of the tabernacle starts at chapter 35, runs to the end of the Exodus. So let's read Exodus chapter 1 together. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it is on page 60. Exodus chapter 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came into Egypt with Yaakov, with Jacob. Each man came with his own household. Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Issachar, Zebulun, Binyamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. And all told, there were 70 descendants of Yaakov, and Joseph was already in Egypt. Now Joseph died, as did his brothers and that generation. The descendants of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and grew very powerful, and the land became filled with them. Now there arose a new king over Egypt, and he knew nothing about Yosef, but said to his people, "Look, the descendants of Israel have become a people too numerous and powerful for us. Come, let's use wisdom in dealing with them. Otherwise, they'll continue to multiply, and in the event of war, they might ally themselves with our enemies and fight against us and leave the land altogether." So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built for Pharaoh the storage cities of Pithom and Ramesses. But the more the Egyptians oppressed them, the more they multiplied and expanded until the Egyptians came to dread the people of Israel, worked them relentlessly, making their lives bitter with hard labor, digging clay, making bricks, all kinds of field work. And in all this toil, they were shown no mercy. Moreover, the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was called Shiphrah, the other Puah. "When you attend the Hebrew women and see them giving birth," he said, "if it's a boy, kill him. If it's a girl, let her live." However, the midwives were God-fearing women, so they didn't do as the king of Egypt ordered, but they let the boys live. And the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and demanded of them, "Why have you done this and let the boys live?" And the midwives answered Pharaoh, "It's because the Hebrew women aren't like the Egyptian women. They go into labor and give birth before the midwife arrives." Therefore, God prospered the midwives, and the people continued to multiply and grow very powerful. Indeed, because the midwives feared God, he made them founders of families. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people: "Every boy that is born, throw in the river, but let all the girls live." Well, time just kind of gets gobbled up here. Between the last verse of Genesis and the opening verse of Exodus, a period of somewhere around 350 years has passed. And the first few verses of Exodus are kind of a bridge between Genesis and Exodus. The thing is that Genesis is not the end of one story, and Exodus the beginning of a new one. They are linked, such that one flows into the next. Exodus is a continuation and a progressive revelation of what was begun in Genesis. So, we are reminded that Jacob and all 11 of his sons that lived with him up in Canaan, along with all their family members, came to live in Egypt. But Joseph was already there. In total, there were originally 70. Now, here's the thing. We're going to get many symbolic numbers in the Torah and the Bible as well. 70 is a symbolic number. On the one hand, Genesis 46, which lists all the male descendants of Jacob by means of both his legal wives and his concubines, gives us the count of 70. However, as we discussed back when we studied that chapter, the number presents problems because it includes two of Judah's sons who died at the hand of God in Canaan, as well as Joseph and his two sons who were born in Egypt. So 70 males of Jacob's family could well be accurate, but on the other hand, 70 is such a round number and such a symbolic number that indicates totality or something that's fully comprehensive, that we have to likely view this number, 70, as symbolic that all of Israel went to Egypt with nobody left behind. Now consider this. We know from Genesis 34 that when the sons of Jacob killed all the males of Shechem in retribution for the rape of their sister Dinah, they took all the women and children as slaves and as concubines. Understand that from an ancient Middle Eastern perspective, these women and children became part of Israel. Further, this number of 70 counts only males. There were at least as many females, and usually there were significantly more females than males in ancient populations because the men were killed in battle or injured on their jobs or some such thing. Therefore, the total actual number of people who went down to Egypt, those who would be reasonably labeled as Israelites, was probably around 200 or so. Now, in later studies, I'm going to show you why that's important to recognize that fact. Now, the bulk of the Israelites still live now some 350 years after their arrival in the same general area that they did when Joseph called for them in Goshen, in the Nile Delta area. Now, the central city they lived in was called Avaris, and Joseph appears to have had a palace there for him and for his immediate family. This city has been found, and there can be no doubt as to its identity. In archaeological terms, this place is now called Tel Ed Daba. It is huge. It would have supported hundreds of thousands of people. And it was Hebrew and Canaanite in its architecture. Now further, more archaeological finds have been confirmed that it was in the land of Goshen, also called Lower Egypt, where the Hyksos rulers of Egypt, the Semite rulers of Egypt, set up their capital city. And not surprisingly, it was in the same place, Avaris. Now, a common refrain from non-Christians and from secular university professors is that the Bible is simply a book full of legends and myths, and that the people and the places in the scriptures, for the most part, never existed. Now, we're told that they never found a place in Egypt where all those Hebrews might have lived. We're told that they've never found a record of Kings Solomon or David, nor of most of the biblical cities. And that's just simply not so. They have found these sites. They have found these records. And when push comes to shove, it is admitted grudgingly. The only reason that many archaeologists and Egyptologists will argue against the conclusion that Tel Ed Da'aba is the city of the Exodus is because they date Avaris to an earlier time than when Bible chronology says the Hebrews should have lived there. And it's the matter of placing these archaeological sites in relation to time that is one of the major issues of archaeology. Now, the current system of dating ancient places and people and events that was established back in the 1800s goes, one of the names it goes by is the Regnal dating system. And it is based on the supposed times of the reigns of certain Egyptian pharaohs. It's a system that is full of huge time gaps, pure speculations, and educated guesses. But more, some of the foundational pillars of regnal dating have, through modern research, just proved to be false. A new dating system called the New Chronology is gaining mainstream academic support very slowly, but surely. And when the New Chronology is applied to the finds at Avaris and hundreds of other biblical sites, the biblical timeline starts to fall perfectly into place. Now, as anyone that has spent time in our advanced educational system knows, the Bible is anathema to these folks. So any system of dating that seems to verify biblical truth, even though the system wasn't devised with that goal in mind, is very difficult to establish in the academic world. Very difficult. And by the way, so you know, a Christian Bible scholar did not devise this new chronology dating system. It was created by a fellow named David Roll, who's an Oxford academic, and he's an agnostic. Now, since the academic world of archaeology had some time ago determined a better dating system was needed, he took the tact that while he doesn't acknowledge any spiritual element of the Bible, that there's no reason to assume that the historical accounts written in the Bible are inherently false or inaccurate. And this assumption has and continues to be, frankly, a foundational principle among scholars and scientists. That if the Bible says it, it's wrong. It never happened. Now, I detour a little to tell you this because I want you to know that when we're reading Exodus, these people and places actually existed, the events actually happened, and many proofs of this have been found, and more are constantly being unearthed. Now, we're told in verse 6 that Joseph died, and along with him, all of that generation, that is, all of his brothers and sisters. Now, we need to picture that generation as, if you would, the immigrant generation. Now, think for a moment just what that means. Practically every one of us born in this room is a natural-born American. However, our parents, maybe our grandparents, were probably immigrants. They came here from someplace else to start a new life, and their experience in America as immigrants who just got off the boat is quite different than for those of us whom they produced. We know nothing of the foreign country our immigrant ancestors knew. We have only known America, American culture. That second and third generation of Israelites, then, you see, was quite different from those who journeyed down from Canaan. Those who had come to survive that great famine thought of their stay as just for a while, just till we get by this. The next generation had little to no thought of going back to Canaan. After all, Egypt was the only home they ever knew. So they were quite comfortable in Egypt. Now, what God, through Joseph, had begun, Joseph's death did not end. Verse 7 says that even after Joseph died, the Israelites continued to prosper and grow in number, and they spread out exceedingly. Yet it was this very purpose of God, this amazing fruitfulness, that was going to lead Israel into a confrontation with a future Pharaoh, an increasingly paranoid Pharaoh. Now, these Hyksos rulers, those Semites from somewhere in the Middle East who were the rulers of Egypt during the time a little before and contemporary with, and then for about a century after Joseph, they continued to favor the Israelites. After all, they were cousins. And while this enviable status of the Hebrews allowed them to prosper, to grow, it was also creating a festering jealousy and a hatred of them by the Egyptians. The end of verse 7 marks the end of life in Egypt as the Israelites had known it. The end of verse 7 is the end of Israel's golden era in Egypt. Now, before we move on into the next era of the Hebrews' time in Egypt, this might be a good time to take out our magnifying glass and look at how Israel was currently structured from a human society standpoint. Because beginning now, in Exodus, and then running out throughout the remainder of the Old Testament, it is assumed that we all understand ancient Hebrew societal structure. Because they're not going to talk about it too much more. You're going to get it now, or you're not going to get it at all. So with apologies to you that may already know all this, for everybody else, we're going to take a few minutes to learn about the titles for the leadership positions, the names for the various subdivisions of the Hebrew people that came from this unbelievable population explosion that they had down there. And if we can learn what they are, each term referring to, we're going to glean some extra understanding every time these terms are used in our studies. Now, let's remember that the nation of Israel was founded by and named after Jacob, who God renamed to Israel. In those days, the name of a new nation, which is nothing more than a new people group, was taken from its founder. Jacob went on to have 12 sons, then, who formed the first subdivision of Israel. Each of those 12 sons would eventually establish their own tribe, their own branch, if you would, of Israel. And of course, each son would be the ruler of that branch, that tribe. Now, these 12 tribes then each produced children who were the next subdivision. And that next subdivision is what the Bible generally refers to as clans, sometimes as families. And as each of these clans or families went on to produce children, those children would mature and produce the next generation or subdivision that the Bible calls households. In more familiar Western terminology, Jacob was the father, the 12 sons the children, the children of them, grandchildren, and their children, the great-grandchildren. But the Bible used different terms for each of these generations. So Israel was the nation, while the 12 sons were the 12 tribes that formed that nation. The sons of the 12 tribal leaders each formed their own clan or family. And while the Bible translators tend to use the words clan and family interchangeably, most accurately for our 21st century Western way of thinking, it would be best to think of these clans and families just as clans and use the word family for another category I'm going to show you in a moment. In any case, the offspring of these clans then formed separate households. Now, out of these households, which we could best equate in our traditional thinking as extended families, came what the Bible sometimes calls man by man. This is not talking about eligible bachelors, ladies. Rather, I think this would best be considered the equivalent of our modern day, I think they still call it, nuclear family, the smallest family unit. That is, a mother or father, and then their children, usually young children, as a unit living together. Now, often Bible translators will call the man-by-man subdivision a family. This should not be confused when these same Bible translators will also call a clan a family. So you can see I can get a little difficult depending on how they translate these words. So the structure of Israel is nation, all of Israel, tribe, there's 12 of them, clan or household, and then man by man, right down to the individual families. Now the Bible calls the leader of a household the head, Rosh, right? Though he's sometimes referred to as a chief. And the leader of each clan is a chief, and the leader of a tribe is called a prince, or sar. So each of the 12 tribes of Israel had a prince. As long as there existed 12 tribes, there were 12 princes. Now these princes were rulers over all the people of their tribe, every subdivision of it. Every clan, every household, every family was ultimately beholden to a tribal prince. His word was law. Now let's keep in mind a trait of these tribal princes that, although obvious on the surface, is nonetheless important. All of these princes inherited their positions. Their heredity is what was counted. While an outsider, whether from another Israelite tribe or even a foreigner or non-Hebrew, could at times be accepted as a member of a tribe, this outsider would never be allowed to become the prince of that tribe. Because absolute proper genealogy, traceable all the way back to Jacob, but even to the proper original son of Jacob, that is the proper tribe. This was required of each succeeding generation to become the prince of that tribe. So the order of prince, chief, and head, this formed the hereditary aristocracy, if you would. That is, when it came to authority, it was, as that old TV series used to be called, it's all in the family. Interestingly, operating in parallel was another class or category of leadership and authority, a sort of elected or appointed class of leaders. And this class of leaders was representative of the common people of the clans and the families and the household, and they were called elders and officers. Often a word substituted for officer is scribe. Now, this class of appointed or elected leaders operated under the authority of the tribal leaders. There's absolutely no way, for instance, that you would ever remove a prince or a chief from his position, except perhaps through assassination. Because his position is given to him as a birthright. Therefore, it was unchangeable, it was permanent. But elders, officers, scribes, they could be removed legitimately from the position if there was enough displeasure on the part of the people for whom they were selected to serve, or if they upset the tribal leadership. Typically, elders and officers and scribes developed their own pecking order. They were further subdivided by their exact duties and a simple management hierarchy like we're all kind of used to seeing at wherever it is we work. I mean, you know, a little fish reports to a big fish, and then that big fish reports to a bigger fish, and so on and so forth. Now, I want you to keep this handy as we go along. These titles and understanding structure and pecking order was really important to the decisions that went on within Israelite culture. And when the Bible uses terms like prince or chief or tribe or clans, these have a very specific meaning. These are not interchangeable words, they're not parallels, and they're not synonyms. Anyway, let's continue in Exodus. As I mentioned earlier, verse 7 ends and verse 8 therefore begins a new and far less happy era for the Israelites in Egypt. We're told that a new king, that is a new pharaoh, arose over Egypt who didn't know Joseph. Simply, this meant that the new king had no intentions of offering any deals that the previous kings, previous pharaohs, had with the Israelites. And this for one very good reason. This new king that's being spoken of was an Egyptian. He was the first Egyptian ruler of Egypt in a very long time. This new Egyptian pharaoh promptly announces that these Israelites, who had been up to now honorable and worthy citizens of Egypt for nearing 200 years, are suddenly deemed a danger to Egypt. And they're a danger because they are many more than we. In other words, the Pharaoh played the race card. Since these hated Hyksos rulers were Middle Eastern Semites, seen as cousins of essentially the same ethnic stock as the Hebrews, they were all lumped together in one big pot. Now that the Hyksos rulers were finally defeated, those who supported those rulers probably looked a lot like those rulers. The Israelites became persona non grata. They would bear the brunt of Egypt's newfound nationalism and their growing paranoia. So, are we to take it that the Hebrews at this point actually, literally, outnumbered the Egyptians, which the Pharaoh says they did in verse 9, or was the Pharaoh exaggerating? Well, yes and yes. While the Hebrews were numerous and they lived throughout Egypt, they were highly concentrated in the land of Goshen. And they well could have outnumbered the Egyptian nationals there. But when you consider Egypt overall, best estimates are that the Israelites would not have represented more than somewhere around 25% of the entire population of Egypt. But boy, that's still a pretty substantial number. Now, it is ironic, is it not, and completely indicative of the ongoing battle between God and Satan, that what God counted as a blessing, the incredible fruitfulness of Israel, Pharaoh counted as a curse. And so the confrontation between good and evil begins. Pharaoh's in a bind. He hates those Israelites, and he fears those Israelites, but he needs those Israelites. He needs them as Egypt's workforce. They are the key to the Egyptian economy and for the hoped-for return of Egypt to a position of becoming a regional power. The solution? Subjugation. Control them. Control these Hebrews. Use them for what they're good at. But keep their population in check, and you sure don't want to let them leave. Don't get the idea, by the way, that the Egyptian population began taking these Hebrews as their house slaves. Rather, it was that the Egyptian government conscripted the Israelite males especially as work gangs for their building projects. It was rather like being drafted into the army, except that there wasn't any pay. And in fact, when what Egypt did to conscript what it did was to conscript Egyptian males in order to create a loyal nationalist military to protect their nation from invasion. At the same time, it was conscripting these bothersome Hebrews as the nation's civilian workforce. Interestingly, there is no evidence that Israelite women were included in this slave labor scheme because the work that was required was pretty much male work, making mud bricks, then constructing houses and buildings, also constructing and maintaining a vast network of canals and waterworks, irrigation projects, building new roads and military fortresses. The Hebrews became the primary group of construction labor in Egypt, and their lives became miserable as a result of it. Well, to a degree, the new king of Egypt's plan worked. The construction projects brought the country back to glory, and the enslavement of the Israelites controlled their movement. But another aspect of his plan failed. Rather than reducing or holding in check the Israelite population, the more the Egyptians oppressed the Israelites, the more children these Hebrews seemed to produce. And the more children the Israelites produced, the more paranoid it made the Pharaoh and his brain trust. So here we see one of the God patterns emerge that's going to continue until Christ comes again. The more you persecute God's people, the more fruitful they're going to become. Israel never grew more or faster. And the body of Christ never grew more or faster than when under the worst persecutions. If Israel had just given up and decided to fully assimilate into the Egyptian society, they may have avoided persecution, but they would have foregone fruitfulness. And as long as believers continue to want to take the easy road, to look more and more like the world so we can avoid persecution because of our identity with Yeshua, the less fruitful we're going to be. So it has been. So it's going to be forever. It's simply the way God's economy works. We have no ability to alter that, by the way. So worried and frustrated was this unnamed Pharaoh that he did something desperate, something that in some ways would be counterproductive to all of his grand purposes. He ordered those who the Bible calls the midwives to the Hebrews to cull the Israelite stock. The plan was that if an infant they assisted into the world was a boy, they were to immediately kill it. Yet had Pharaoh actually succeeded in all this infanticide, he would only have reduced the workforce available for his aggressive construction aspirations. Well, his plan didn't work. These midwives who knew and feared the Hebrew God didn't obey the Pharaoh. Civil disobedience. In fact, what we have here is essentially the first recorded instance in the Bible of civil disobedience in order to obey God's morals and ethics, which are often in direct opposition to men's morals and ethics. This rather brave defiance was conducted by women. Men. The two women named here as midwives are Shifra and Puah. Without doubt, they must have been something like the senior midwives in charge of many more midwives, because two would never have been enough to handle probably what was hundreds of daily births taking place among the Israelites all over Egypt. Now, being a midwife was actually one of the few professions open to women in that era. It was respected, it was valued, and it was needed. Now, a midwife primarily was there to assist the woman in her labor, to cut the umbilical cord, to wash the newborn, rub it down with salt. And in the case of twins, it was the midwife who would testify as to which one was born first. Naturally, when a set of which of a set of male twins came out first was most important, because the one that came out first would receive the firstborn blessing. The second to arrive would not. So midwives were held in high esteem. Their function was vital. Midwifery was also quite organized, and the midwives were paid by those whom they served. There was a midwife guild. Probably Shifra and Puah were head of the guild, which is why Pharaoh would specifically summon those two, not just a couple of common midwives. Well, as an interesting aside, many Bible scholars doubt that these midwives were Hebrews. The Hebrew wording of the sentence makes it a little bit ambiguous in that regard, because the words can be taken to mean Hebrew midwives or midwives of the Hebrews. But this conclusion is drawn for a couple of reasons. First, it's unimaginable that the Pharaoh would have been so dumb as to honestly expect Hebrew midwives to kill their fellow Hebrew newborns. Second, these women in verse 19 obviously know something about how Egyptian women experience the birthing process, as they comment that Hebrew women give birth faster than the Egyptian women. And since Egyptians at this time wanted nothing to do with Hebrews, it's hard to imagine a Hebrew woman being the midwife employed to help an Egyptian mother give birth. Very probably, Shifra and Puah were Semite women, but not Hebrews. In fact, their names are of obvious Semite origin, but they're not Hebrew names. Now, we should also take note here that in spite of the distinctly male-oriented world of tribal society, and I'm sure many of you ladies would say not much has changed since then, the Torah makes these two women into honored heroines. We will see often in the Bible how women are painted as used of God and venerated by the people. In fact, as we approach the story of Moses, watch, as you're going to see women are going to be some of the main characters. Well, having failed, still unable to stem the tide of Hebrew population increase, Pharaoh turns to the Egyptian populace in general. He tells them to monitor the situation. Spy on your neighbor. So when they see a Hebrew woman about to give birth, he's made it their responsibility to do something about it. For sure, the average Egyptian didn't take this infant from its mother and destroy it any more than the average German in World War II would have wandered around killing Jews. Rather, they would have reported it to government authorities. And they would have had people come and take the newborn, if a male, throw it to its death in the waters of the Great Nile. Well, this is irrational fear at its worst, because there's no record of Israel trying to take over the government of Egypt, or rebelling, or even conniving with a state enemy. Actually, Pharaoh's actions could do nothing but harm Egypt's ability to carry through with his ambitions. But it's not going to be the last time that Israel is, for some bizarre reason and way, blamed for a nation's problems. And they pay an enormous price in blood for that paranoia. In fact, this behavior towards the Jewish people will become a pattern throughout history and right up to this day. Now, one more thing, and we're going to end the first chapter of Exodus. Remember I told you about Hebrew word patterns. And I named four words that recurred in various forms throughout Exodus. Now, we're going to run into one of them here in Exodus 1. And that word is serve. However, our English translations kind of mask this recurrence by translating the same basic Hebrew word in several different ways. Look at verses 13 and 14. Look at 13 and 14. Most of our Bibles will say something to the effect of making the Israelites do hard labor, work imposed on them, rigorous labor, something like that. Now, usually the English word chosen in this section of Exodus is labor, but the original Hebrew root word is abad, abad. Various forms of abad are used five times within the verses 13 and 14, five times. So if we took these verses in their most literal Hebrew sense, bringing with it the Hebrew word style and intent to make a point by the repetitive use of the word abad, it would read like this. So they, Egypt, made the children of Israel subservient with crushing labor. They embittered their lives with hard servitude in brick and mortar and with all kinds of servitude in the field, all their service in which they made them subservient with crushing labor. That's how it would sound. When this Hebrew word pattern is uncovered, we can see an important scriptural principle emerge that otherwise is pretty obscured. It's this: whom you serve determines the nature of that service. Whom you serve determines the nature of that service. When we serve God, all of our service is voluntary to Him. It's positive, it's good, it's lovely, it has an eternal quality of truth and light. When we serve Satan, in this case through Pharaoh, but often it's through serving ourselves, our own desires, what we are participating in is servitude. Forced, negative, evil, not fruitful. And whatever is produced from it's going to burn up, right along with everything else that this world is about at the end of days. At this point, verses 13 and 14, in Exodus we see only the negative side of the word serve, of abad. A little bit later, we're going to see the positive side of serve. But it's much harder to pick up this much intentional wordplay with the English translation. Next week, we'll begin chapter 2.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.